AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. A Dallas hospital lab worker and her husband have left a cruise ship where she was in self-imposed quarantine over the last few days. The woman works in the same hospital where Thomas Eric Duncan died of Ebola and two nurses became infected. She has shown no signs of the disease. The 48 people who had their first extended contact with Duncan face a milestone.
This is a critical weekend. If we don't see new patients this weekend, then we're going to see the remainder of those 48 that we were tasked with following come off the list.
Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins. A memorial service was held for Duncan in Salisbury, North Carolina. His nephew, Josephus Weeks, says Duncan was a big-hearted, compassionate man. He adds that he will find out what happened to his uncle.
I don't have much, but what I do have is the God-given talent of speaking the truth. And that day will come when we will have answers for what happened to my brother.
Duncan's neighbors in Liberia believe he was infected when he helped a pregnant neighbor who later died from Ebola. Parents of missing University of Virginia student Hannah Graham are waiting for tests to confirm that remains found by searchers yesterday are those of their 18-year-old daughter. There's been an exchange of gunfire along the border between North and South Korea. AP's Hyungjin Kim reports that it all began as about 10 North Korean soldiers were spotted walking toward the demilitarized zone.
South Korean soldiers then broadcast warning and fired warning shot against those North Korean soldiers, but two shots believed to have been fired by those North Korean soldiers were found at a South Korean guard post.
No one was hurt. This is the second such shooting event along the border this month. This is AP Radio News. Catholic bishops meeting in Rome put aside what could have been a landmark welcome to gays, a sign of deep divisions at the end of a two-week meeting called by Pope Francis to change the church's approach to families. National Catholic reporter analyst Thomas J. Reese says part of the report didn't get the necessary two-thirds vote, paving the way for more discussions before next year's synod.
Some bishops said one thing, other bishops said something else. So I think we're going to have a conversation in the church about these issues, and then we'll find out what the synod says next year.
Cleanup day in Bermuda after Hurricane Gonzalo. Maria Firth owns a pair of beachside vacation cottages.
We have had a lot of foliage damage, trees coming down, branches, obviously leaves everywhere, trash. But structural damage, we are thankful that we have not had any.
There's no major damage, injuries, or deaths from the storm. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Danger Zone. New, tough, direct, uncompromising. Saturday morning, 7 a.m., 1500 on your AM dial. Insider information on the trouble spots of the emerging world. India, Egypt, Morocco, and their crowded regions. From retired U.S. Marine Special Forces Operator Colonel Bill Cowan and me, retired U.S. Ambassador Dick Carlson. Nothing else like it on radio or TV. Danger Zone, Saturday morning, 7 a.m. on 1500 AM.
Green light. Hey, girl. School zone. I'm getting hungry. Car changing lanes. You want to meet me for pizza? Stop sign. Intersection clear. Yeah, street. Pizza sounds good. Ball in street? Girl in street!
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
The traditional light bulb, a groundbreaking invention in 1879. It's time we switch to longer-lasting Energy Star light bulbs. They're more efficient than the old bulbs, like a text message is more efficient than a carrier pigeon. And they cut down on our energy costs. Because in our own groundbreaking age, we deserve a light bulb that saves us some cash. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at EnergySavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Tyson's Corner offices of Offutt Kerman. This is your host, Dana Theus, with InPowerCoaching.com. We have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, starting with Glenn Ogilvie, CEO of the Center for the Nonprofit Advancement, Scott Fosbach, head of the Education Advisory Board, Pamela Aria, CEO and co-founder of Optensity, and Paul Villela, president and CEO of Higher Strategy. We start off with Glenn Ogilvie, CEO of Center for Nonprofit Advancement. Glenn, what is the Center for Nonprofit Advancement?
The Center for Nonprofit Advancement is an association of nonprofits. Nonprofits are organizations that put forward a charitable purpose. Our association helps them to be stronger and more vibrant and ultimately sustainable.
So how did you get involved with such an interesting organization?
You know, I'm what folks may refer to as the accidental CEO. I started during my college career wanting to live off campus and having to take part-time jobs in order to make that a reality. I took a number of different jobs, the last of which was at a group home for court-involved youth. I took that job not because I thought that I'd spend the rest of my life serving people and communities in need, but because I thought that it was an opportunity to study in a home environment while working.
So you did it for selfish reasons and you discovered something else.
That's correct. And I discovered it was, in fact, a nonprofit after the fact.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City on Staten Island.
And what were you doing as a kid?
As a kid, I was pretty focused on service and volunteerism. I was the young person who always helped the elderly with their lawn, with their snow. Very involved. I attended Catholic schools, K through 8, and then a very prestigious private school for high school.
And what were mom and dad doing?
My mom's in a helping profession. She's a nurse. And my dad was in law enforcement, a corrections officer right on Staten Island.
And what were you doing on the playground? Who were you playing with?
Interesting. So I grew up in a pretty challenged neighborhood. And on the playground, there were always young people who found the wrong things to do. But with two parents who were very determined and focused on discipline, I was the one who always shied away from the bad and focused on more of the good. Those young people, though, however, didn't have as much success, so I was able to see their struggle and challenge firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever tempted to be a bad kid?
Well, I was tempted, but I knew that the repercussions would far outweigh whatever was fun in the moment.
So you were thinking ahead even back then?
That's correct.
So tell us about a turning point in your life when you just realized, you know, maybe I'm not going to be who I thought I was going to be.
Yeah, you know, I think that turning point was working at that group home.
In college.
In college, sure. I realized then when I was able to help those young people to be successful in moving toward their educational goals and their personal goals, to stay away from the wrong that they were doing, the reasons they were there in the first place, that it was something inside of me that created that connection. I was able to relate to those young people because they were the young people from the playground, mm-hmm. Those that didn't have a stable home as I did and the discipline-focused parents. So I went back and did a master's degree just so I could keep doing that work, focused on guidance and counseling from a community perspective, and continued in the nonprofit sector from that point forward.
And you said earlier that a lot of your peers at that point, getting out of college, were going off to the stock market.
That's right.
And they were taking a very different track. Was that tempting for you, or did you just kind of always know?
You know, I always knew. There was this notion, and we still fight that stigma today, that the nonprofit sector is not one where you can sort of have a good career and support your family. And we prove that wrong every day. We help people to realize that from a salary standpoint, as well as personal comfort, this is the place to be, and that it's a lifelong position and capacity. You see the benefits of your work every day.
So that's interesting. Talk more about that stereotype and why it's a stereotype.
You know, they say the nonprofit sector is the only sector that tells you what it's not instead of what it is.
Interesting.
But it really should, and some are now calling it the social profit sector. We are helping people and communities. We make just as much profit, but we reinvest that into the mission versus sharing it with shareholders.
That sounds like a pretty important shift in thinking about a very important sector of our economy.
That's right.
That's amazing. Who came up with that?
Yeah, so we have a very strong network, over 1.5 million nonprofit organizations in the country, all focusing on good charitable purpose, from health to education. It's the sector that's most needed. Everyone benefits. Every corporation benefits from folks who are able to work and raise dollars that they can then spend in their businesses. Education is also rampant. So the nonprofit sector actually solves a lot of the challenges that we hear about day to day.
Mm-hmm. Brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers and two sisters.
Oldest, youngest?
I'm the second to oldest.
You're the second oldest, yeah. The penultimate,
that's,
sort of.
Is that what that's called?
I'm not sure.
Sure.
What did being in the middle of the pack but almost on the top mean for you growing up?
You know, it's interesting, and I say this to all of our executive directors, you don't have to have the position to be a leader. So while being second oldest, I do consider myself and realize that I was the go-to child and very much the leader, and continue to be that in my family. So you can lead from behind, you can lead quietly, but you just have to do it. You have to take charge.
So what did being the go-to leader in the family as a child look like?
Sure. So for me, I was the helping profession guy. It was the lawn for the neighbor, the snow, but it was also the trash and the dishes and everything else inside the house.
You were the responsible one.
That's right. And it's interesting how that plays out today, and I do think that a lot of those skill sets that I developed as a young person, I'm still reaching for today as CEO of this $27 million organization, and helping to bring people together, find common ground, and work toward the greater good.
Mm-hmm. When you look back at your childhood, which it sounds like it was almost like a combination of weird factors,
uh-huh.
Right? So you're in a challenging neighborhood with friends playing on the playground that are getting into big trouble, and you're the good kid doing the volunteerism. How did that play out? Did you grow up with a worldview that you think is different than a lot of other people that become leaders?
Yeah, I think I did, because I was able to see all ends of the spectrum. So challenged neighborhood, bused to a prestigious private school. I was able to get a lot of diversity and have those experiences with different people, different cultures, different socioeconomic levels. And then to reach for all of those skills in a position like the one I'm in now, because I serve a very diverse population.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that it was very helpful, very beneficial. That exposure is beyond, valuable and something that you continue to reach for.
You have children.
I do.
Is it harder being a parent or running a $27 million organization?
Yeah, I think it's harder running the organization, especially with it being an organization that works beyond its walls. It's not just, internal, focused on the staff members, but it's the nearly 1,000 organizations that depend on us. So it's much bigger than we are. The children, I think it's easier coming from the household I came from, that disciplinarian, focused on education, it's never good enough, continue to strive for more, and it's what we instill in our children, my wife and I, so it works out.
So having parents you admire makes being parenting a little easier.
It does, and especially when they're around and they are the grandparents,
they're still around.
Yeah, both of my parents are around and very much available, and both of my wife's parents, so we have this team.
That's awesome.
To help raise our children at the moment, which is fantastic.
That's awesome. So going back to your dinner table as a child.
Sure.
What would your siblings say about you back then?
I think they would say that I'm annoying and I'm always talking. They'd probably say that, it's interesting because at school I always got in trouble for talking. I was always the people person, and my son gets into it for that now.
Interesting.
So I think, you know, you have a lot to say because you have thoughts and views about everything from the dishes to whose turn it really is to do the chores. So I think they'd say I was annoying.
That's interesting, though. So that, but it sounds like the thing that annoyed your siblings and that thing that annoyed your teachers came in handy as a professional.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I guess that's when I was molded to be this extrovert, which most CEOs benefit from. Bringing people together and being that energy in the room versus that introverted, not as interested in talking and being more out there.
Yeah, I love that. So if mom and dad were sitting with us right now, would they be surprised at your success today?
I think they would be surprised. And I realized from a long career in youth development, working at different nonprofits and also at as a funder, you say a lot of things and you do a lot of things and you don't see the benefit right away. So it's years after that the switch turns on and you see the change that you were pushing and striving for all along. So my parents probably would be surprised. They'd be surprised at the things I'm saying that I appreciate from their disciplinary standpoint and focus on education. So
what would you like to say to them if they were here that maybe you've never said before?
You know, I always say it, and I think it's a lot of thanks and appreciation. Having two children and knowing what the running around is for sports and education and homework and everything else just blows me away to think how they did it. Having five children and working modest jobs, sometimes two at a time.
Yeah,
and
wow.
Still being engaged and involved. So it would be super thanks and lots of appreciation.
It's a lot to be grateful for.
Absolutely.
What's the website?
So we are at nonprofitadvancement.org. And that's the Center for Nonprofit Advancement.
This is Dana Theus. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. Here for today's Business Spotlight is Chris Vannetti, Vice President of Contract and Project Staffing Services at Hire Strategy. Chris, what is Hire Strategy?
Hire Strategy is a D.C. Metro-based professional services and staffing firm specializing in information technology placements as well as HR and administrative, sales and marketing, and accounting and finance.
And what do clients love about working with Hire Strategy?
We take an old school approach to staffing. And what I mean by that is, you know, back in the day before social media and email, it was all about people. And we're one of the few and last firms in this marketplace, probably nationwide, that really interviews in person, takes the time to know their candidates, and 100% takes the time to know their clients, their pushes and pulls, the positives and negatives, to make the right match. So it's truly a consultative approach.
Mm-hmm. What do employees love about working for Hire Strategy?
It's definitely our culture. And the employees that work for us, I think they would all to a person say, we believe in leadership, not management. And that's one of our key mottos. And leading people is a definite thing that we like to do, and we like to do it often.
So what does that mean for a new employee? They get to be a leader?
They can get to be a leader, but they're a leader of their own practice, of their own business. We allow them to be entrepreneurial. We allow them to make their own decisions, and we're there to help them along the way, correct them if need be. But motivation and leadership is the one way that we think that people are going to excel with us.
What do you love most about your job?
I love that I get the opportunity to be a leader and to be entrepreneurial and work with a great bunch of people. And a great group of executives along with myself. So it's a great place to be.
What's the website?
The website is www.hirestrategy.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theus. My next guest is Scott Fosbach, head of the Education Advisory Board. Scott, what is the Education Advisory Board?
It is a firm that provides best practice research, consulting, and data analytics to colleges and universities. We work with about 700 all across the country. We've got about 70 in the 51st state, which is Canada, and we have a couple overseas.
And they come to you why?
To solve the big problems that everyone reads about in the papers these days, which is higher education costs too much and too few kids graduate, and those who do graduate can't get jobs. So how do we fix the education system?
As a parent with kids in college, I appreciate very much what you're doing. How did you get involved with this particular organization?
It's interesting. The Education Advisory Board is actually part of a larger company called the Advisory Board Company. It's a big firm that works in healthcare that it always looked to get into the higher education space. In fact, we've been looking for about 15 years. but the growth on the healthcare side was always so robust that we always said, you know what, this isn't the time. And I remember 7 years ago now, I sat down with the CEO and said, look, Frank, there's never going to be a good time for us to get into higher ed. Let's just do it. And he said, go for it. And that was the moment that got us into higher education.
And you told a great story about how at that moment in time for you, you realized you were starting to get bored and you needed something new.
Yeah, I think my life has been a series of pivots when I've kind of been there, done that, and wanted to do something different. I'm someone who's not high on execution, but loves to create new things. And I've been working in the healthcare space. We had just gone public as a company, and I was involved in that, and I was looking for the next challenge. And so this seemed to be it.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pittsburgh. I was one of three kids. I was raised by a single parent. My dad left us when we were five, and grew up in a neighborhood where, interestingly enough, for someone in higher education, no one went to college. No one in my immediate family had ever gone to college. So it's sort of interesting that I ended up in that space.
What was you were how old when your dad left?
About 5 years old.
And you were middle child?
I was the youngest of three. Yeah.
Okay. So being the baby when dad left, I mean, what did that kind of give to you that you've seen turn into an asset in your life?
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything good about being an only child, but I do know growing up there were two things. One, I was just driven. I was not going to stay in Pittsburgh. I was going to get out of that town. And for me, going to college was the way out. And the reason I thought that is I did have one uncle. My mom was one of 13 children. She was second generation. Her mom and her dad had both come over from Europe. And two of those uncles, two of her brothers had gone to college. They went to World War II. They came back, and the GI Bill gave them a chance. So it was one of those uncles who was kind of like a father figure to me, and I was determined to get out, and he made it clear to me that I was going to go to college, even though none of my classmates had that ambition.
But was he the one you said, I love this, he took you to the ball game 1 week and the library
he would,
the next?
During the summer, every weekend, I would go to a Pirates game, but every weekend I would go over to the Carnegie Public Library, and he would see to it that I was checking out books.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Have there been other mentors in your life that you realize, like he, you know, really helped you get to that next level for wherever you were at?
I think I would point to my first boss. After I left graduate school, I came to work for the advisory board company. It was founded by a man named David Bradley. David is I guess you would describe him as a serial entrepreneur. He's taken two companies public. He now runs the Atlantic Media in D.C., and he was a combination of Stephen Hawking and Barnum and Bailey, incredibly bright, but had a real knack for merchandising and actually creating things. I learned what I know about business from him.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, and so you talked about how your life is a series of pivots, and I love that description because isn't life always a series of pivots? When you were a kid, this desire to pivot, to get bored. I mean, it probably wasn't always an asset when you were sitting in school, was it?
It wasn't, and I was always curious, and I would always ask the question why, and that would get me in trouble. I was a really good student. I mean, by the third or fourth grade, you know, I was a voracious reader. I loved to read. I failed English. I don't know if it's in the third or fourth grade where they teach you how to diagram a sentence.
Yes.
You might remember that antecedents, participles, prepositions. I didn't understand why one did that, and I paid absolutely no attention. And despite my teachers calling my mother and so forth, I failed. And to this day, I'm a fantastic writer, but if you were to ask me to diagram a sentence, I have no idea how.
Right.
And I am like that now. When someone brings me something, and they can't answer the question why. Why is it done this way? Why are we doing it this way? What's the rationale? I'm pretty quick to say, let's just not do it.
So did you realize back then, even when you were in the middle of a failure, which as a child, when you fail a class can be, you know, kind of catastrophic, did you feel like a failure, or did you feel like there was something else going on?
You know what? I think probably back in the third or fourth grade, I felt a little bit like a failure. But across my life, what I realized, I mean, I went to college and was going to be a pre-med and decided I didn't want to be a pre-med. Instead, I went to graduate school in history at Harvard. And then decided I didn't want to teach, and I ended up.
Tell us your PhD story.
I get bored quickly. I quickly got through all of the requirements for the PhD. I took my general exams and all of that. And then you get to the dissertation. Now, at Harvard, the average PhD dissertation in history might be 7 or 9 years. Some people slave away 14 or 15. I could never settle in on a topic. I would get a topic. I felt like I understood where it was going to end up, and I didn't want to do the detailed work. And I remember walking into my PhD advisor, who was the leading colonial American historian in the country, and saying, look, can I do a bare bones dissertation? And he just looked at me and he said, well, at Harvard, we don't do bare bones dissertations. And that's when I decided, you know what, we should probably part ways.
Well, it's what's interesting to me about that story. And like you said, you're not into the execution, but you're into the ideas. Some people see that as a weakness. You've turned it into a strength.
Yeah, I think I always tell people, figure out what your gift is and run deep in your gift. But then also realize that there are things you're not as gifted in, and those are the blind spots. You have to be, there's a threshold that you have to hit there, but you're never going to be great. Find people who are. So if folks say, you know, how are you building a business in higher education? You know, I'm not the person you would look to execute on things, but I make sure that I'm surrounding myself with folks who are really, really good at that.
What was the earliest example you can remember of where you kind of saw that in operation and realized, hey, I don't have to be good at everything?
Yeah, it's a good question. I recall in graduate school, I was not the, you know, I didn't want to do the research. So we would get groups of students together. I would typically be the person who would do the whiteboarding of ideas, and they would rely upon me for that. But then other members of the team would actually be the ones heading for the library to do the work. And I was more than happy to do that, and they were more than happy to let me figure out the plan of attack, if you will.
So you sort of began to emerge as a leader, just as you said, leveraging what you like to do and were good at.
Fair, yes.
Yeah.
And there are other people, you know, who love the details.
Yeah.
So if you can get that partnership, it works perfectly.
Right. So it's not necessarily about what you aren't good at, it's who you can align with and partner with.
That's right.
To get stuff done. Yeah. I love that. Do you have children?
I do. Again, that's another pivot and challenge. And, I think a life without challenges is not a lot of fun. I had my first child when I was 51 years old. She's now 4 years old, going on 5. And my wife and I are thinking maybe having one more.
Wow. So what's it like having a 4-year-old when you're a mature adult? There are many people who have 4-year-olds when they're still growing up.
You know, it's interesting. I think there's something wonderful about having a child when you're at this stage of your life. I've got time. I have resources. And I can step back. There are some folks who said, my God, you know, my job or raising a child, which is harder, easy call for me, job. I mean, for me, having a child is just it's just been a wonderful experience. I'm not sure I'd have said the same thing if I had had a child when I was, say, 25 or 30.
Yeah, right. it is a different experience. What have you learned from parenting, you know, that kind of was a new thing for you and maybe even helped you with your job?
Patience. I think I am not the most patient person in the world. And maybe as someone who's not keen on execution, I can kind of overlook that sometimes things take time. And I think what my child has taught me, she teaches me this every morning, I take her to school, patience. And I'm still learning that lesson with her.
Yeah, well, most of us keep learning that lesson. What does success mean to you now?
It's twofold. One, I get a real kick out of building a business. So for me, I keep score. You know, we're now working with 700 universities. We've been picking up maybe 100 a year. And it's just looking at how fast we're growing as a company. But the other for me is, what impact are we having? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I look at my own higher education experience. It was tough getting through. And that's one of the biggest challenges facing higher education. I don't think most people realize it, but 35-40% of all students who start a post-secondary degree don't finish. And that's something that we're focused on. And for me, it's asking, are we having an impact on that metric for the colleges that we work with?
Mm-hmm. What's the website?
The website would be EAB.com. So Education Advisor Board, EAB.com.
This is Dana Theis. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offutt Kerman. What is Offutt Kerman, Doug?
Offutt Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tyson's Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work with in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into two particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying. And since then, he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offuttkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offutt Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theus, with InPowerCoaching.com. Next up, we have Pamela Aria, co-founder and CEO of Optensity. Pamela, what is Optensity?
Optensity has built a platform called Optsymphony, which allows you to very easily build data analytics in the cloud.
All right. Why co-found a data analytics in the cloud company?
Well, I got my start in the startup world when I was hired for a startup in L.A. called Applied Minds, and I worked there for many years, and I really enjoyed the process of creating technology and spin it out. So I always, after I left there, I had an idea to take a piece of technology and spin it out into a company, and big data became the answer.
So you must have entrepreneurship in your veins. Both your parents must have been entrepreneurs, right?
No, both my parents were college professors. I grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia, and they both taught at West Virginia University. They were taught physics and chemistry, and so I always thought when I grew up that I would also be a science professor.
So what were you doing when you were a kid? What was your first job?
My first job was a camp counselor for the National Science Foundation summer program.
So on that track to college professorship, right?
Right.
And so what were your brothers and sisters doing?
My sister is also a mechanical engineer, and she works in software today.
So science really ran in the family.
Yes, totally. Our parents were very pro-science, and they always wanted us to just do science. That was their dream.
Which is not a common dream for women.
Growing up, my parents were very, very supportive of my interest in math and science, and as well my peer group in high school and middle school, so I never experienced the kind of stigma that other women have. And I was very surprised as I got older to find out that there are a lot of women who shied away from math and science careers because of that. And so I always take the time to try and tell young women that science and math is a great field for them and very fulfilling, and recommend it.
And you do spend time mentoring women.
I've spent a lot of time mentoring women in various organizations, both through my university and through women in technology organizations.
So what would you say, give us a nugget, a kernel of advice for parenting young girls, or we're teaching young girls, or we are young girls, you know, what's a key piece of advice you can give us to why women in the sciences can be successful and should be?
I think it's a field where you your success is very numerative, so people can clearly see that you're successful, and then they can put aside the fact that you may not look like them or you may not be the same age as them. So people are looking for very driven people who can have success and are not, and that kind of numerative success makes it a good field for us. And it's also very exciting. Technology is a very exciting field, and that's why I like it, and that's why I think other people should do it.
So I'm curious, you had a lot of support for being a science geek as a kid. When you got out into the work world, did you find it was different, or did you continue to find people that would support you?
For the most part, I found for myself that people were somewhat surprised, but always helpful that that was my career field.
So what do you think is different for you than for other women who run into resistance and end up, you know, sort of shying away?
For me, it was both my parents. My parents were people who did what they wanted and felt strongly that you shouldn't care what other people thought of you. My mom got a degree in nuclear engineering in the early 60s. My dad wrote a bunch of physics textbooks in his third language, English, and they never really cared what other people thought of them, and I sort of took that to heart and decided I would do what I wanted to do regardless of what other people might think.
Your dad came over from India, is that correct?
Yes.
So what was it like growing up in sort of, you know, a dual culture family?
It was a bit unusual. I was probably the first person in my school that was sort of a mixed raced person.
Really?
Yes. And as well, my dad was the first Indian in Morgantown.
The first?
Yes.
Person from India,
yes,
in the town.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. But there weren't a lot of understanding of identity around being biracial back then, so I didn't really experience it in that sense, like, because there was no one else who was that. It was almost like I didn't understand it.
So maybe it was cool, right?
Yeah.
Have you had anything that you would consider kind of a turning point in your life where you thought you were going one direction and you ended up going in another?
I think my turning point was taking the job at Applied Minds. I met Danny Hillis in the cafeteria of the National Reconnaissance Office, and we really clicked, and taking that job from thousands of miles away really changed my life.
Did it feel like a big risk?
It didn't to me. When he offered me the job, I said yes immediately, but other people said, wow, that's a risk.
Did he offer it to you in the cafeteria?
No, by phone later on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So why do you think it didn't feel like a risk? If everybody else around you was going, oh my gosh, you know, why didn't it feel risky to you?
I just, in my heart, I felt I was confident it was something I could do and that it would work out.
Yeah. So you had sort of an inner knowing that this was the right thing for
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I think if we pay more attention to that, most of us would be more successful. And so you grew up with a sister,
mm-hmm.
and your parents were encouraging you both to get into the sciences, but you have two sons.
Right.
So how does that, what is it like being a scientific and math-oriented mother of sons?
Well, I actually think that raising children today, regardless of whether they're sons or daughters, there's a lot of issues around how to make your education relevant and have a career. And I think a lot of people don't pay attention to boys and their career achievement as much as they should.
Well, that's interesting because
yeah.
we tend to think it's the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you notice in having sons that makes you say that?
I think they have some of the same questions that girls do, is how can I find my passion? What step should I take to find my passion? How can I get an internship and a career path that would interest me? I think they have the same questions as girls.
Do we just assume they'll get it?
We do. We assume they'll get it because historically they have. And I'm not sure that's true in today's society.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something we need to look at.
So I want to go back to you were working, before you started Uptensity, you mm-hmm. were working in an organization that was spinning off technology into other mm-hmm. startups, and you decided you wanted to go be in a startup. Mm-hmm. So when you made that transition to actually starting a company, what were some of the biggest things that surprised you? You're like, whoa, I wasn't expecting this.
I think the biggest thing that surprised me was how much I didn't know about accounting and finance.
And how important it was.
How important it was. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was a lot. There's a lot of things that's, you know, that you need to do when you run a company related to that, and I just didn't have any experience in that.
You know, that's interesting because there's a lot of people that think, oh, math, I mean, finance is just a bunch of math, right? But you were a math whiz. Apparently, right. There was something else to it.
It's a different kind of math.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So now that you've actually been doing it for a while, mm-hmm. what do you enjoy most about your job?
I still enjoy most seeing someone use our product. So showing them what they could do with the product and seeing them use the product. That's what I enjoy most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does success mean to you now?
Well, whenever you're building a piece of technology, if you're the inventor or the builder of the technology, in your heart you think it's the most useful thing in the world and you can't wait for people to use it. So the biggest feedback of success you can have is when someone else says to you, wow, that's really cool. I want to use the tool.
Yeah, I really want this.
Because you really need outside validation of all of your dreams in building it. Yeah.
I'm curious, your parents, are they still alive?
My dad is no longer alive. My mother's alive.
Okay. Did your dad see you start this business?
No, he didn't.
No. What do you think? What does your mom think about you starting your own business, and what do you think your dad would have thought? Would he be surprised?
I think my dad would have been surprised. He never saw science and business together. Mm. My mom is still completely supportive of me, and she's actually, over the years, helped me tremendously with emergencies with my family life, you know, raising my sons when I have a business meeting. So. She's done a lot of that.
She's seen how hard it can be.
Yes. Yes, yeah. She is.
Exactly. If she were here today, what would you like to tell her maybe you've never told her before?
I couldn't have done it without her.
Mm, yeah. I like it. What's the website?
www.optensity.com. That's spelled OPTENSITY.
This is Dana Theis. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment after this Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn & Burnett so special?
We are first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here. And they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohn & Burnett?
CohnAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A-N-D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis. Next up, I have Paul Villela, President and CEO of Higher Strategy. Paul, what is Higher Strategy?
Well, Higher Strategy is a staffing firm. We are involved in putting people to work, building teams across the greater Washington area.
Why staffing?
Why staffing? Staffing sort of was accidental for me. Mm-hmm. I wound up in that industry a few years ago and turned out that I enjoyed it, was relatively good at it, and that passion turned into developing my own firm back in 2000.
So Higher Strategy is your company. You started it.
I did start it. I started it with a couple other people who worked with me before, and we've done well. We've done well.
Was it your first entrepreneurial venture?
It really was, yes. It's the first firm that I actually started and have grown as a sort of independent entrepreneur. I've had other leadership roles with firms, but this is the first business that I started.
Did you always know you wanted to start a business?
I felt kind of as I developed academically and in my early professional career that I would do that. I wasn't certain when, and I knew I had some intention around building a foundation in my career to work towards that.
So this is really interesting. So you sound like you're really thinking through and preparing for something you felt like you wanted to do. Where did you grow up? What was going on when you were a kid? Were you a thinker and a planner?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I grew up in a military family. Mm-hmm. My father was an officer in the Army, and we moved every 2 years or so. Mm. And I saw him in both leadership roles and also with some discipline and process in the way he approached things. And I think I inculcated some of that, as well as some of the charm and occasional personability from my mom.
Uh-huh.
And those two things together kind of, I think, led me, whether intentional or not, towards this end.
So moving around a lot has got to be hard on a kid. What do you remember from the having to move around a lot that was both the really hard part and maybe something that was good?
Yeah, I was the youngest of four in my family, and I watched my older siblings in their triumphs and struggles, around.
You get to see all the examples of
exactly.
what not to do.
I learned pretty quickly that this was going to be a habit for the family, moving quick routinely. And what I started to do was recognize I got to get in there and make friends fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go into schools and be very as gregarious as I could be as a young developing boy, and join clubs and run for leadership positions and posts and formulate my own clubs, things of that nature. And what it did is it helped me network, I guess, in essence, within the community I was in, and quickly evolve some friendships.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you come into an environment new and you felt you had the confidence to go run for school president or something. I mean, a lot of kids would come in and say, oh, I want to be here a couple of years, but you didn't have that luxury. You found you really didn't need to be there a couple of years.
I didn't. I mean, of course, you mentioned earlier, it's not all good, right? There were some bad, and part of it was you develop those friendships and some of them become important relationships, and you know in your heart that they're going to be gone. You're going to move on. And
that was
some
back
of those,
before Facebook, wasn't it?
Exactly, right. It's funny. I have reconnected with some through those social media outlets. But that was a challenge. But I knew that it was working for me, and it was just part of my personality. It became my personality, if you will, kind of reaching out, developing these relationships quickly.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you were the youngest.
Yes.
And being the baby, you got to learn from everybody else. But what would your siblings have said about you back then? What do you think? What was your role in the family?
Oh, well, I think that, they were torn. One is he gets to do everything. They as the older siblings had all the rules imposed on them. And by the fourth one, you just give up. And I'm kind of kidding. They're tongue in cheek. So there's that sort of envy, if you will, in a way. But really, at the end of the day, for a variety of reasons, I think that I became a bit of a family leader. I think I was just always motivated. And although the youngest, so I could listen to reason and experience from my older siblings, they did look to me. For some reason, I kind of became a leader in the family.
That's really interesting. So as the youngest child, what did it look like to be a leader in the family? What were you doing?
I was in, this is part of just my personality, organizing activities, helping to manage the household as my mother went back in the workforce, you know, as I was becoming a teenager, things of that nature. You know, I remember just one story for you that build a matrix of days and what would be for dinner and who would cook it. And, you know, maybe a little overstep my boundaries, but just little things, really.
Were you channeling your dad's military precision and planning, you think?
I think so. It certainly wasn't intentional, but I believe that I witnessed that, learned it, saw the good in it, and balanced it with some other things that developed into me not wanting to become a military professional, but ultimately feeling like I wanted to do something on my own as a leader. And then ultimately, as a young adult, recognizing I should be an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. What, when you finally went into entrepreneurship and started your own company, did you feel like, yay, I finally made it, this is what I've always wanted to do? Or did you say, oh my gosh, this is a lot of work?
Well, it certainly was a lot of work. I really enjoyed it. And I, even to this day, the business is thriving and growing. So, one of my key roles is keeping that entrepreneurial spirit, even as we have aged a bit as a company and grown and become larger. When starting the business, I think what I felt more than anything else was, why did I not do this sooner? At the same time, I was always really grateful for the foundation that I built in a corporate environment and then later in a consulting environment, that I had a lot of freedom. I think whether it was what I exhibited and others saw in me to allow me to have freedom to build groups and build teams and lead projects, or just, you know, my assertive nature to go and grab it. But I never felt, you know, repressed, if you would.
I'm curious, because it sounds like you've had leadership roles all along, and you go back to that, you know, when you were the youngest kid in the family, leading the family. What do you see the common themes are between, you know, what you were doing at 14 leading your family and what you do today running a successful business?
Very similar, but particularly in my early career, I felt like I sometimes pushed boundaries around coming into an environment, one of the youngest, but asking for tasks and roles that would require leadership.
So wanting it and letting other people know that you wanted it.
Yep.
I think that's a good lesson for all of us. Sometimes we think someone's going to see our potential and give us the leadership opportunity, but a lot of the times we want people to lead who want to lead.
That is true. And I think that, you know, the caution I would say and some of the lessons learned were that there were occasions where I felt like I was a bull in a china shop, that, you know, the finesse and the kind of the charm part of it that I mentioned earlier came later, you know, and improved. So maybe it wasn't always well received, but I did get a lot of opportunity very early. And I was really, as I mentioned, very grateful for that, because I think it helped shape who I am today.
What was your first job?
So my first real job was a janitor for a bank.
And how old were you?
I was 15. That's okay. Right. Yeah, it was just legal.
So you really, your first job was working for a bank.
That's what I like to say, yeah. So if people really want to know, yeah, I worked for a bank. But I was part of a janitorial team. It was really a very interesting summer experience.
Interesting how?
I kind of brought process to an otherwise chaotic environment. The actual custodial engineers were allowed a lot of freedom about how they accomplished things. But method and process was applied so differently. And it was really a teaming and collaborative environment at the end of the day. And I kind of took advantage of that and worked well with my partner. And we were very efficient, highly rated, and it was get the job done and you can leave. So we were out of there.
Uh-huh. So you were motivated.
We were, yes.
That's interesting that, you know, a janitor job, so many people think, oh, some of these jobs, there's no opportunity there. And you turned it into a real learning opportunity.
I guess I did.
Mm-hmm. What? Tell us what success means to you now.
You know, I always define success a variety of ways, but for me, as it relates to business in particular, it is the ability to grow and service the business community that we're involved in. I love the business of Washington. I find it fascinating, and having been a part of it for a couple of decades, to see how it has evolved and a much more integrated, diversified business platform has been fascinating. It kind of is one of the elements of this staffing business that I find so interesting. And to be able to grow the practice, evolve people's careers professionally and see them grow personally, while we're satisfying these customers, that's really what drives me. That's success for me in the business side.
And last question about success at home. You have a daughter.
I do.
And you've said she's been influential in your leadership style. If she were here with us right now, what would you like to tell her about what she's done for you in your life?
Well, I mean, she's done so much. We don't have time for all of that. But what I would say is that as it relates to me and growing as a person and a leader, she's had amazing influence. And part of it is that she herself is this amazing independent being. And yet, of course, as a young child, she's also very dependent. So it's a nice blend. And I began to recognize that she, again, it was sort of unintentional. She wound up bringing to me some softness to my approach of leadership that has been very beneficial, I think.
Some of that finesse that you were talking about.
Yes.
What's the website?
The website is hirestrategy.com. It's spelled H-I-R-E strategy.com.
This is your host, Dana Theis. I'd like to thank our sponsors for today's shows, Offutt Kerman in Tyson's Corner. I would like to thank our guests, Glenn Ogilvie, CEO, Center for National Nonprofit Advancement, Scott Fosbach, head of the Education Advisory Board, Pamela Aria, co-founder and CEO of Optensity, and Paul Villela, president and CEO of Higher Strategy. I'd also like to thank you, our listening audience, because without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Right now, millions of American children are living below the poverty line, with parents struggling to provide the very basics for their families. Parents are being forced to make drastic decisions between food, shelter, and clothing. You can make a difference today by partnering with Operation Warm to provide new winter coats to children in our community. Will you join us as we make sure no child is left out in the cold? Donate today at OperationWarm.org or call 800-733-WARM. That's 800-733-WARM.
The 14th Annual March of Dimes Heroines of Washington Gala will honor women who exemplify leadership and are making a difference in our community. From CEOs to rising stars, this year's finalists will be recognized for their significant volunteer contributions at a Black Tie Awards presentation on Tuesday, November 18th at the Ritz-Carlton Tyson's Corner. All proceeds from Heroines of Washington will benefit the March of Dimes mission to give all babies a healthy start in life. Since 2001, the event has given awards to 80 heroines and has raised more than $1.7 million to support the March of Dimes effort to help women have full-term, healthy pregnancies and healthy babies. To learn more about the March of Dimes, to purchase tickets to Heroines of Washington, and make a donation, visit marchofdimes.org/heroines. Join them in celebrating these inspiring women who go above and beyond to improve our community.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle, simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial.